music is called jazz, and it's about as far away from the music that my next guest, Billy McCarthy, played. Billy, welcome to the show.
Hey, Rick. It's good to be with you. Thank you.
It was good to read your book. It's not a short book, but my God, I'm amazed you're still alive. You write, you give a quote. You weren't self-destructive in the way that some were, but you do pull at the beginning of the book a great, great Hunter Thompson quote. The music business is a cruel and shallow money trench, a long plastic hallway where thieves and pimps run free and good men die like dogs. There's also a negative side. That's a great quote, and this is truly a terrific, terrific book. Beat Me Till I'm Famous. It is a memoir that talks about your... I'm going to read some from it. Do you mind?
Oh, not at all.
It's been almost 25 years since I left Chicago for Hollywood, and I remember the day I began my race. It first got into my blood. Listen to comedian Jay Leno on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson one night. Jay said he wanted to, quote, make it, unquote, and earn a nice living before his parents died. I thought, yeah, makes sense. Take care of your parents. Sign me up. You had no idea what you were signing up for, did you?
No, not really. But, you know, once you get, you know, I grew up, you know, on the south side of Chicago, of course. Once, you know, the ultimate goal, obviously, for any musician, you know, when you're during a period that we went out in the 80s, after playing drums, you form a band, and the carrot is, of course, the record deal. So,
well, you're also, you know, it's Wes Pullman and Calumet Park, and you're yes. self-taught, too, basically, aren't you?
Yeah.
You're a self-taught drummer, and I mean, the book is basically, Billy, a fascinating kind of, you're a little, pretty starry-eyed, too, wouldn't you say?
I mean, starry-eyed in a sense that I was just fortunate to, like, end up, it's like the book jumps, it just leaps from one scene to another scene.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, I'm hanging out at Rodney Dangerfield's pad in like Connecticut. Producing
That's one of the weirdest transitions ever. Yeah, you're out in L.A. What fascinates me, and you have a really, really, I think, great, great recall for details and a real facility for writing dialogue. The book, Beat Me Till I'm Famous, comes in, I don't even know how many chapters are in this book, Billy, but they are quick, they are to the point.
Yeah.
You go out there with the dreams, as a lot of kids did in the 80s, that you were going to be the next, you're going to be the next Guns N' Roses, or that you're set for, you're the next Van Halen, you're the next Motley Crue, and it ain't easy, is it?
No, not at all. In fact, when I went out to California, my parents were on vacation when I was 17 on the South Side. First set of drums. So, by the time I was 20, 21, I was playing in like one of the hottest Chicago bands. And then I got a call out to L.A. And when I got out to L.A., next thing I knew, I was like, after 4 years of playing, I was in the studio with Eddie Kramer, who produced Jimi Hendrix and Led Zeppelin. Yeah, and I'm like, you know, I thought like, well, you know, he loved our band. I was in a band called Kid Rock, and we were managed by Bill O'Coin, who discovered Kiss and Billy Idol. And, you know, I thought, oh, this is great. You know, yeah, I'll do this session with this guy. He produced Kiss. Well, I didn't have any idea that he did Jimi Hendrix. So when, you know, that we finally got through the tracks and everything, I was kind of frightened to find that out. I was like, oh, my God, can't believe it. I made it through that.
But in many ways, your sort of youthful naivete kind of served you well. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons you survived this craziness.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, you go out there with four guys from Chicago and they're your brothers and you know, you literally are brothers and you're all working together for that dream. You know, like getting a record deal isn't about like, oh, I'm a rock star. You know, look at me. You know, it was just about, great, we scored the carrot. Now let's make it happen.
Right.
And there was so much turmoil in the band that actually attributed to the the way that we did our shows, it actually helped us because we had so much tension within the band. But I think the core of the band is really like getting, you know, anyone who's ever lived in the 80s or anyone who's a musician, this is a great book because you're going to learn from it. You're going to laugh. You're going to, it's, there's a lot of sad moments in there.
I agree. No, there are a lot. When your dad dies, it almost broke my heart. Let me ask you, Billy, in writing this, you'd written a novel before, a novel that I had not heard of and didn't know anything about and I'm going to read because I like this so much. In writing a memoir, there's a certain, you know, hard honesty that you have to cope with. Was that true for you? And you really do have to. It's not like sitting on a psychiatrist's couch, but it's pretty close.
It is, because you get done with the book and you go, well, what the hell did I just do? I'm putting the whole world out. I'm throwing it out there to the whole world.
Yeah.
Things that happened to me. But I think this book, what separates this book from all other books that, you know, like guys who made millions off of rock.
Sure.
And I want to get back to when I arrived in L.A.
Oh, yeah. No kidding.
Moses. Well, that was when we got to L.A. when I was like 21. I went back. I failed the first time after 4 years. Came back with an empty bag of nothing, and I was supposed to bring back the gold. Then I regrouped with the Malls, and then we went out to California, and it turns out we got a record deal offered to us in 2 weeks.
One of the great things, let me read. I just want people to get a sense of your writing, if that's okay.
Yeah.
And the chapters are wonderfully, I think, wonderfully short. They help the narrative drive of this book. But you write here about the name change of the Malls. People in Chicago, particularly on the South Side, drool on the word "the." Often, "the" comes out more like "duh." The Bears. Right. Desi stopped at my house unannounced a few days after the Haywire show and shared that he was changing the name of the band to the Malls. Huh? I said. You know, he said. The Thumbs, a popular Chicago band. The Girls. The Guys. I was slightly stumped, and that's a bad sign in marketing a new product. Yet, there was more to his visit. After pussyfooting around, he asked me how I liked the show, blah, 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 blah. I think that's fascinating. That is a time when you guys hit the Rush Street scene pretty hard, right?
Yeah, we did. We after our second rehearsal, we had a format together. We had, you know, whenever we went out, we had two blondes, two brunettes. Well, we went to Rush Street, and we didn't even, it was our second rehearsal. And we just pulled up at a cafe, and we're sitting there, you know, all decked out in our clothes and everything.
And your hair.
Clothes and our hair, right? Yeah. Our hair was very important back then.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, people are like, you know, what's the name of your band? Where are you guys from? We said California because we figured, hey, tell them you're from L.A. when you're in Chicago and vice versa, right? So next thing you know, I mean, we have like 150 people asking for autographs.
Yeah.
It's so strange.
And
that's what I said in the book. We had the world by the, you know, before we even stepped on stage.
I know. And I'm thinking that place was probably Melvin's, but I, you know, who knows? Who knows the bar?
No, it was right across the street from Mother's, actually.
Oh,
anyway,
okay.
To make a long story short, we only played Chicago probably twice.
Yeah.
We played the Riviera twice and played the Thirsty Whale once. But our thing was L.A. And when we got out to L.A., it was like a big fraternity. It was Guns N' Roses, us, Poison. We were all dead broke.
Yeah, I know.
So everybody got a record deal one by one.
Yep.
And we saw all these bands, like, just totally that we used to hang out and drink with, you know, just take it to another level.
But it is a fascinating story. I'm talking this whole half hour. And Billy, I'm going to be in touch with you. You're a fascinating enough story. I'm going to write about you too, I think. And how do you know Arnie Bernstein? It is quite possible I might never have seen this book, let alone read it. And how do you know Arnie?
I know Arnie on my first book, The Devil of Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Arnie and I met at a Borders book signing, and we became friends.
He's a good guy.
He's a wonderful guy. Oh, yeah. He's a great, incredible writer too,
and very encouraging too. We got to take a quick commercial break, and I'll be right back to you, okay? This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio. on TuneIn. I'll be back in a couple of minutes with Billy McCarthy, the author of Beat Me Till I'm Famous.
Listen, learn, laugh. 720 WGN.
Welcome back. I'm talking to Billy McCarthy, the author of Beat Me Till I'm Famous, which is it's not rollicking. It's rollicking sometimes, and it's rough sometimes. It's of his journey from the south side of Chicago to Los Angeles and to Sunset Strip and back again. And we lost him on the phone, so I'll read a little something. Well, Joe will get him back on the phone. Everybody seems to be, they get nervous when I talk about their books. But he's a kid who born in West Pullman, sort of raised in Calumet Park, and a mother, a father, three sisters, a younger brother. And his first real concert, I'll tell you, because I've read the book, was Cheap Trick and UFO in Hammond. But then in the early 80s, he goes out with stars in his eyes. And it's a back-and-forth trip from L.A. and Sunset Strip to Chicago and up and down and up and down. You change your name at one point, Billy, to Billy Dior.
Right.
That's a very funny section in the thing, but it just... It shows, are you sometimes, Billy, in retrospect, and having finished the book, do you think of yourself as a survivor?
Oh, absolutely, because there's so many people in the book that have died and left.
Yeah.
I actually finished this book, Rick, in 2008 after The Devil of Shakespeare, and then I went on to produce Ferocious Drummers, which is a documentary on...
which sounds really fascinating.
Well, thank you. It is fascinating, and I have some people looking at it right now to kind of rekindle that up. But I want to go to a lot of people that I've lost, you know, through the days. And I was fascinated when you were talking to Joe and Mike earlier. You were mentioning Derek, Johnny Frigo.
Yeah.
And Johnny Frigo's son was Derek Frigo from the band Enough's Enough, popular Chicago band.
Right, sure.
And, you know, we used to hang out when I would fly into Chicago, us and Enough's Enough, of course, they're from my neighborhood. I grew up across the street from Chip's Enough in Cuyahoga.
And
Johnny would, we'd go over to Johnny's house, me and Derek, at like 2 a.m. with some girls, you know, doing our thing when we were in our 20s.
Uh-huh.
And Johnny would get up in his boxer shorts and start playing the violin.
My God. He was an incredible guy. I mean, Johnny was really...
He was incredible. Yeah. And so, you know, Johnny and Derek were extremely close. He used to call his dad daddy all the time. Daddy, can I have this guitar? Daddy, can I have this? And Derek ended up, you know, ODing about 10 years ago. And it just devastated Johnny. So,
I remember. You know,
he's one of the many people that, you know, we lost in the book. And, that I came up with. So, yeah, I would call myself a survivor for sure.
Well, you write in the book, I'm going to read another, you know, and I'm not the only person who could have told you this, you're a very talented writer. You really are. I mean, there's a real narrative drive to this book. You talk about going to L.A. in, you know, let's say 2008, and you write, I make it a point to dissect the pretty faces whenever I reach a stoplight in the heart of the money pit on Sunset Plaza. I try to sort the winners from the losers and even those who have yet to realize they're dying. I wish I could eavesdrop into every chess game over lunch and act as coach and mentor. I'd tell them what not to do and to never stop doing it. I wish everyone could have lived the 80s in Hollywood. I know that some of us wouldn't come out alive, but never knew those closest to me would soon be looking in from above. That's very, very solid. Solid writing. You finished this in 2008, and sort of put it away to work on the documentary, which sounds pretty fascinating about interviews with Ferocious. The title is Ferocious Drummers. You can go to Facebook and see some of what's happening with that documentary, Billy.
Well, what's happening is, you know, I put a lot of heart and soul into that,
sure.
And you know, I was, you know, I went back. I said that, you know, I after I finished the first book, I was going to do the second book. I started it. I finished it. And then I got this idea on the film. So it basically it's on hiatus right now. But, you know, people come and go. You have meetings.
Hollywood. Yeah. The movie business. Yeah. The movie business makes the rock and roll business look like, you know, an accounting firm. You know what I mean?
Right. So I rolled the dice. I took over after that, and I rolled the dice heavy, and I took my own financial from my painting business that I have, you know, and I said, I'm going to forget about it. I just want to paint. That's it. I love the people, Mr. and Mrs. Jones. So anyway, I got like 14 of the biggest, 15 of the biggest drummers in the world, from Hal Blaine, mm-hmm. the great Hal Blaine,
yeah,
to Carmine Appice and Sean Pelton, the biggest guys in the world, sat with me one-on-one, and I didn't tell them either. I was in this band called The Mall. They just said I was a former recording artist and drummer, and they loved the idea. And I can't, you know, we're still figuring it out right now.
Sure.
It just seems like it's such a deep film, you know, taking you through jazz, taking you up through the 50s, the 60s, and
that's a fascinating.
I really want to get this.
It's a fascinating idea. It's a fascinating idea. You know, the other part of this book that is just, I mean, it's all, many parts of it, Billy, and I say this with great admiration, yeah. It's almost like surreal. You wind up becoming friendly with and working to produce Rodney Dangerfield's son, Brian, right? And you wind up going to Connecticut, and you wind up hanging in that world where you meet, you know, Robert Ludlum before he's a big shot and a very hard drinker.
Yeah.
Did you ever get a, and then there's a, then Streisand comes into the whole picture too.
Yeah. It's funny. Well, you know, Westport was funny because Robert Ludlum lived around the corner from Rodney.
Yeah.
Rodney had a summer home there. That's where we worked out of. And, you know, to make a long story short, I picked up the book, The Bourne Identity, one time on his couch, and I was like, oh, can't read this. It's too heavy for me, right? And tossed it. Now it's the biggest film ever, right?
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, it was a really great circle to be in, and I'll tell you, Rodney Dangerfield's kid, a genius. Ooh. A genius, a musical genius. He's like between Bob Dylan and I'm not saying this lightly, between Bob Dylan and, like, I'd say Don Henley.
Wow.
Petty, if you put him in a blender.
Yeah.
And, you know, he just had a fear about letting his dad know what he was doing because, you know, dad is king.
Yeah.
So I was basically like the stepchild for like 12 years. Wow. I would hear everything every night and all these stories. So, I mean, and, you know, I haven't spoken to Brian in a number of years. He's dealing with whatever he's dealing
yeah,
with,
sure.
which is, you know, he has some health issues. So, but no, I was
it
really
makes,
privileged.
I got to tell you, though, Billy, it makes very interesting reading. The whole thing, the Southside kid chasing his dreams, man. It's chasing his dreams. The book is called Beat Me Till I'm Famous. The author is Billy McCarthy. He was once known as Billy Dior, but forget that. It's in the book. You'll read all about it. Billy, I'll be in touch in a while and write a story about you, because I'm very taken with this whole, mostly with your honesty in the book. And you're a good writer, too. So Arnie Bernstein.
Thank you.
Arnie Bernstein's a genius for putting us together. And I enjoyed the book. I enjoyed the book tremendously. I look forward to meeting you face to face.
I do too, Rick. Thank you so much.
Happy holidays and all that jazz, as they say. Okay?
You too, Rick.
All right, Billy.
Okay?
Take care.
Thank you.
Interesting guy. The book, a very interesting book, Beat Me Till I'm Famous.